effects of recent blasting, gathered around a 2-meter fissure opened in the fall, and a path winding out of sight beyond. Kovach? There was a brittle lightness to the query in Han's tone. I see it. When did you update the construct? Han stalked closer to examine the blasting marks. Today. Tanya Wardani nodded to herself.
High-orbit satellite geoscan, right?
That's correct.
Well.
The archaeologue turned away and reached in her coat pocket for cigarettes.
We aren't going to find anything out here, then.
Hansen!
Han cupped his hands and shouted into the fissure. The induction rig he was wearing apparently forgotten.
I hear you!
The demolitions expert's voice came thrumming back on the rig, detached, and edged with a smirk.
There's nothing back here.
Of course there isn't,
commented Wardani, to nobody in particular.
Some kind of circular clearing about 20 meters across, but the rocks look strange, kind of fused.
That's improvisation, Han said impatiently into the rig mic. The MAI's guessing at what's in there.
Ask him if there's anything in the middle,
said Wardani, kindling her cigarette against the breeze off the sea. Han relayed the query. The answer crackled back over the set.
Yeah, some kind of central boulder. Maybe a stalagmite.
Wardani nodded.
That's your gate,
she said.
Probably old echo-sounding data the MAI reeled in from some flyby area recon a while ago. It's trying to map the data with what it can see from the orbital view, and since it's got no reason to believe there's anything in there but rocks...
Someone's been here, said Hand, jaw set.
Well, yes.
Wardani blew out smoke and pointed.
Oh, and there's that.
Anchored in the shallows a few hundred meters along the beach, a small, battered-looking trawler wagged back and forth in a longshore current. Her net spilled over the side like something escaping. The sky whited out. It wasn't quite as rough a ride as the IDNA said it had been, but still the abrupt return to reality impacted on my system like a bath of ice, chilling extremities and sending a shiver deep through the center of my guts. My eyes snapped open on the expensive empathist psychogram art.
Oh, nice, I grumbled, sitting up in the soft lighting and groping around for the trodes.
The chamber door hinged outward on a subdued hum. Han stood in the doorway, clothing still not fully closed up, limbed from behind by the brightness of normal lights. I squinted at him.
Was that really necessary?
Get your shirt on, Kovach. He was closing his own at the neck as he spoke. We've got things to do. I want to be on the peninsula by this evening.
Aren't you overreacting a li-
He was already turning away.
Han, the recruits aren't used to those sleeves yet, not by a long way.
I left them in there.
He flung the words back over his shoulder.
They can have another 10 minutes. That's 2 days in virtual time. Then we download them for real and leave. If someone's up at Dangrek ahead of us, they're going to be very sorry.
If they were there when Sovereign went down,
I shouted after him, suddenly furious.
They're probably already very sorry, along with everyone else.
I heard his footsteps receding up the corridor. Mandrake man. Shirt closed up, suit settling onto squared shoulders, moving forward. Enabled. About Mandrake's heavy-duty business. While I sat bare-chested in a puddle of my own unfocused rage. Part 3. Disruptive Elements. The difference between virtuality and life is very simple. In a construct, you know everything is being run by an all-powerful machine. Reality doesn't offer this assurance, so it's very easy to develop the mistaken impression that you're in control. Quellchrist Falconer. Ethics on the Precipice. Chapter 18. There is no subtle way to deploy an IP vessel across half a planet. So we didn't try. Mandrake booked us a priority launch and landing parabola with a cartel suborbital traffic arm, and we flew out to an anonymous landing field on the outskirts of landfall, just as the heat was leaching out of the afternoon. There was a shiny new Lockheed Matoma IP assault ship dug into the concrete, looking like nothing so much as a smoked glass scorpion someone had ripped the fighting claws off.
Emily Vongsgraff grunted in approval when she saw it.
"Omega Series,"
she said to me, mainly because I happened to be standing next to her when we climbed out of the cruiser. She was fixing her hair reflexively as she spoke, twisting the thick black strands up and clear of the flight symbiote sockets at her nape, pegging the loosely gathered bun in place with static clips.
"You could fly that baby right down in Corporation Boulevard and not even scorch the trees. Put plasma torpedoes through the front door of the Senate House, stand on your tail and be in orbit before they blew."
"For example," I said dryly. "Of course, with those mission objectives, you'd be a Kempist, which means you'd be flying some beaten-up piece of shit like a Moai 10. Right, Schneider?" Schneider grinned.
"Yeah, doesn't bear thinking about."
"What doesn't bear thinking about?"
You bet Quickshank wanted to know.
"Being a Kempist?"
"No, flying a Moai,"
Schneider told her, eyes flickering up and down the frame of her Maori combat sleeve.
"Being a Kempist's not so bad. Well, apart from all the pledge singing."
Cruikshank blinked.
"You were really a Kempist?"
"He's joking," I said, with a warning glance at Schneider. There was no political officer along this time, but Jiang Zhangping at least seemed to have strong feelings about Kemp, and there was no telling how many other members of the team might share them. Stirring up potential animosities just to impress well-shaped women didn't strike me as all that smart. Then again, Schneider hadn't had his hormones wrung out in virtual that morning, so maybe I was just being unduly balanced about the whole thing. One of the Lock Mitt's loading hatches hinged up. A moment later, Hand appeared in the entrance in neatly pressed combat camellia chrome, now smoky gray against the prevalent hue of the assault ship. The change from his usual corporate attire was so complete it jarred, for all that everyone else was similarly dressed.
"Welcome to the fucking cruise," muttered Hansen.
We cleared for dust-off 5 minutes before Mandrake's authorized launch envelope opened. Amelie Vongsgraft put the flight plan to bed in the Lockmitz data core, powered up the systems, and then, to all appearances, went to sleep. Jacked in at nape and cheekbone, eyes shuttered down, she lay back in her borrowed Maori flesh like the cryo-capped princess in some obscure settlement years fairy tale. She'd scored perhaps the darkest, slimmest built of the sleeves, and the data cables stood out against her skin like pale worms. Sidelined in the co-pilot's seat, Schneider cast longing glances at the helm. "You'll get your chance," I told him.
"Yeah? When?"
"When you're a millionaire on Latimer." He shot me a resentful glance and put one booted foot up on the console in front of him.
"Ha fucking ha."
Below her closed eyes, Amelie Vongsavath's mouth quirked. It must have sounded like an elaborate way of saying, "not in a million years." None of the Dangrek crew knew about the deal with Mandrake. Hand had introduced us as consultants, and left it at that. "You think it'll go through the gate?" I asked Schneider, trying to extract him from his sulk. He didn't look up at me.
"How the hell would I know?"
"Just what..."
"Gentlemen..."
Amelie Vongsavath had still not opened her eyes.
"Do you think I could have a little pre-swim quiet in here, please?"
"Yeah, shut up, Kovach,"
Schneider said maliciously.
"Why don't you get back with the passengers?"
Back in the main cabin, the seats on either side of Ordani were taken by Hand and Sun Li Ping, so I crossed to the opposing side and dropped into the space next to Luc Dupre. He gave me a curious glance and then went back to examining his new hands. "Like it?" I asked him. He shrugged.
"It has a certain splendor, but I'm not used to being so bulky, you know?"
"You'll settle into it. Sleeping helps." The curious look again.
"You know this for certain, then? What kind of consultant are you exactly?"
"Ex-envoy."
"Really?"
He shifted in the seat.
"That's a surprise. You'll have to tell me about this."
I caught echoes of his movement from other seats where I'd been overheard. Instant notoriety, just like being back in the wedge. "Long story, and not very interesting."
"We are now 1 minute from launch."
Amelie Vongsavath's voice came through the intercom, sardonic.
"I'd like to take this opportunity to officially welcome you aboard the fast assault launch, Nagini, and to warn you that if you are not now secured to a seat, I cannot guarantee your physical integrity for the next 15 minutes.
There was a scrabble of activity along the two lines of seats. Grins broke out among those who had already webbed in.
"I think she exaggerates," remarked Dupre,
smoothing the webbing bond tabs unhurriedly into unity on the harness's chest plate.
"These vessels have good compensators."
"Well, you never know. Might catch some orbital fire on the way through."
"That's right, Kovach," Hansen grinned across at me. "Look on the positive side. Just thinking ahead."
"Are you afraid?"
Zhang asked suddenly.
"Regularly. You?"
"Fear is an inconvenience. You must learn to suppress it. That is what it is to be a committed soldier, to abandon fear."
"No, Zhang,"
Sun Li Ping said gravely.
"That is what it is to be dead."
The assault ship tilted suddenly, and weight smashed down on my guts and chest. Blood-drained limbs, crushed out breath.
"Jesus fucking Christ!"
said Ole Hansen through his teeth. It slacked off, presumably when we got orbital and some of the power Amelie Vongsavath had rammed into the lifters was allowed back into the onboard grav system. I rolled my head sideways to look at Dupre.
"Exaggerates, huh?"
He spat blood from his bitten tongue under his knuckle and looked at it critically.
"I would call that exaggeration, yes."
"Orbital status attained,"
Vongsavath's voice confirmed.
"We have approximately 6 minutes of safe transit under the landfall high-orbit geosync umbrella. After that, we're exposed, and I'll be throwing some evasive curves, so keep those tongues tucked up safe."
Dupre nodded glumly and held up his blood-spotted knuckle. Laughter down the gangway.
"Hey, Han," said Yvette Cruikshank. "How come the cartel doesn't just put up 5-6 of those HOGs, wide-spaced, and finish this wall?"
Farther down the opposite row, Marcus Succiati smiled very slightly but said nothing. His eyes flickered toward Ole Hansen.
"Hey, Cruikshank!"
The demolitions expert could have been speaking on Succiati's cue. His tone was withering.
"Can you even spell, Marauder? You got any idea what kind of target a HOG makes from shallow space?"
"Yeah."
Cruikshank came back stubborn.
"But most of Camp's marauders are on the ground now, and with the geosinks in place." "Try telling that to the inhabitants of Sabreville,"
Wardani told her, and the comment dragged a comet tail of quiet through the discussion. Glances shuttled back and forth up the gangway like slug-thrower shells chambering.
"That attack was ground-launched, Mistress Wardani," Zhang said finally.
"Was it?"
Han cleared his throat. "In point of fact, the cartel is not entirely sure how many of Kemp's missile drones are still deployed off-planet."
"No shit," grunted Hansen.
"But to attempt high-orbit placement of any substantial platform at this stage would not be sufficiently..."
"Profitable?"
asked Wardani. Han gave her an unpleasant smile.
"Low risk."
"We're about to leave the landfall HOG umbrella,"
said Amelie Vongsavath over the intercom. Tour guide calm.
"Expect some kinks."
I felt a subtle increase in pressure at my temples as power diverted from the onboard compensators. Vongsavath getting ready for aerobatics around the curve of the world and down through re-entry. With the HOG setting behind us, there would be no more paternal corporate presence to cushion our fall back into the war zone. From here on in, we were out to play on our own. They exploit and deal and shift ground constantly. But for all that, you can get used to them. You can get used to their gleaming company towers and their nanocopter security, their cartels and their HOGs, their stretched over centuries unhuman patience, and their assumed inheritance of godfather status for the human race. You can get so you're grateful for the there but for the grace of God relief of whatever little flange of existence they afford you on the corporate platform. You can get so it seems eminently preferable to a cold, gut-swooping drop into the human chaos waiting below. You can get so you're grateful. Gotta watch out for that.
"Over the rim,"
said Amelie Vongsavath from the cockpit. We dropped. With the onboard comp running at combat minimum, it felt like the start of a grav jump, before the harness kicks in. My guts lifted to the base of my ribcage and the backs of my eyeballs tickled. The Neurochem fizzled sullenly to unwanted life, and the bioalloy plates in my hand shivered. Vongsavath must have nailed us to the floor of Mandrake's landing envelope and piled on everything the main drives would give her, hoping to beat any distant early-warned Kempist anti-incursion systems that might have decoded the flight path from cartel traffic transmissions. It seemed to work. We came down on the sea about 2 kilometers off the Dangrek coast, Vongsavath using the water to crash cool re-entry surfaces in approved military fashion. In some places, environmental pressure groups have gotten violent over this kind of contamination, but somehow I doubted anyone on Sanction 4 would be up for it. War has a soothing, simplifying effect on politics that must hit the politicians like a betathenatine rush. You don't have to balance the issues anymore, and you can justify anything. Fight and win, and bring the victory home. Everything else whites out, like the sky over Sabreville.
"Surface status attained,"
intoned Vongsavath.
"Preliminary sweeps show no traffic. I'm going for the beach on secondaries, but I'd like you to stay on your seats until advised otherwise. Commander Hand, we have a needle-cast squirt from Isaac Carrera you might like to have a look at."
Hand traded glances with me. He reached back and touched the seat mic. "Run it on the discrete loop. Mine, Kovac, Suchiati."
"Understood."
I pulled down the headset and settled the discrete reception mask over my face. Carrera came online behind the shrill warble of unraveling scrambler codes. He was in combat coveralls, and a recently gelled wound was livid across his forehead and down one cheek. He looked tired.
"This is Northern Rim Control to incoming FAL 931/4. We have your flight plan and mission filed, but must warn you that under current circumstances, we cannot afford ground or close detail aerial support. Wedge forces have fallen back to the Masson Lake system, where we are holding a defensive stance until the Kempist offensive has been assessed and its consequences correlated. A full-scale jamming offensive is expected in the wake of the bombing, so this is probably the last time you'll be able to communicate effectively with anyone outside the blast zone. Additional to these strategic considerations, you should be aware that the cartel have deployed experimental nano-repair systems in the Sabreville area. We cannot predict how these systems will react to unexpected incursions. Personally,"
he leaned forward on the screen,
"my advice would be to withdraw on secondary drives as far as Masson, and wait until I can order a reprise front backup to the coast. This shouldn't involve a delay of any more than 2 weeks. Blast research..."
A ripple of distaste passed across his face, as if he had just caught the odor of something rotting in his wounds.
"Is hardly a priority worthy of the risks you're running, whatever competitive advantage your masters may hope to gain from it. A wedge incoming code is attached, should you wish to avail yourself of the fallback option. Otherwise, there's nothing I can do for you. Good luck. Out."
I unmasked and pushed back the headset. Hand was watching me with a faint smile tucked into one corner of his mouth.
"Hardly a cartel-approved perspective. Is he always that blunt?"
"In the face of client stupidity, yes. That's why they pay him. What's this about experimental..."
Hand made a tiny shutdown gesture with one hand, shook his head. "I wouldn't worry about it. Standard cartel scare line. It keeps unwanted personnel out of the no-go zones."
"Meaning you called it in that way?"
Hand smiled. Suchiati said nothing, but his lips tightened. Outside, the engine note shrilled.
"We're on the beach,"
said Amelie Vongsavath.
21.7 kilometers from the Sabreville crater.
Chapter 19. Clotted White. For fragments of a second, standing in the hatch of the Nagini and staring across the expanse of sand, I thought it had been snowing.
"Gulls," said Hand, knowledgeably, jumping down and kicking at one of the clumps of feathers underfoot. "Radiation from the blast must have gotten them." Out on the tranquil swells, the sea was strewn with mottled white flotsam. When the colony barges first touched down on Sanction 4, and Latimer and Harlan's world, for that matter, they were, for many local species, exactly the cataclysm they must have sounded like. Planetary colonization is invariably a destructive process, and advanced technology hasn't done much more than sanitize that process so that humans are guaranteed their customary position on top of whatever ecosystem they are raping.
The invasion is all-pervasive, and from the moment of the barge's initial impact, inevitable. The massive ships cool slowly, but already there is activity within. Serried ranks of clone embryos emerge from the cryotanks and are loaded with machine care into rapid growth pods. A storm of engineered hormones rages through the pod nutrients, triggering the burst of cell development that will bring each clone to late adolescence in a matter of months. Already the advance wave, grown in the latter stages of the interstellar flight, is being downloaded, with the minds of the colony elite decanted, awoken to take up their established place in the brand new order. It's not quite the golden land of opportunity and adventure that the chroniclers would have you believe. Elsewhere in the hull, the real damage is being done by the environmental modeling machines. Any self-respecting effort at colonization brings along a couple of these eco-AIs. After the early catastrophes on Mars and Adirassian, it became rapidly apparent that attempting to graft a sliced sample of the terrestrial ecosystem onto an alien environment was no elephant ray hunt. The first colonists to breathe the newly terraformed air on Mars were all dead in a matter of days. And a lot of those who'd stayed inside died fighting swarms of a voracious little beetle that no one had ever seen before. Said beetle turned out to be the very distant descendant of a species of terrestrial dust mite that had done rather too well in the ecological upheaval occasioned by the terraforming. So, back to the lab. It was another two generations before the Martian colonists finally got to breathe untanked air. On Adirassian it was worse. The colony barge Lorca had left several decades before the Martian debacle, built and hurled at the nearest of the habitable worlds indicated on the Martian astrogation charts, with the bravado of a Molotov cocktail hurled at a tank. It was a semi-desperate assault in the armored depths of interstellar space, an act of technological defiance in the face of the oppressive physics that govern the cosmos, and an act of equally defiant faith in the newly decoded Martian archives. By all accounts, pretty much everyone thought it would fail. Even those who contributed their copied consciousnesses to the colony's data stack and their genes to the embryo banks were less than optimistic about what their stored selves would encounter at journey's end. Adirassian, as its name suggests, must have seemed like a dream come true. A green and orange world with approximately the same nitrogen-oxygen mix as Earth and a more user-friendly land-sea ratio. A plant life base that could be eaten by the herds of cloned livestock in the belly of the Lorca, and no obvious predators that couldn't be easily shot. Either the colonists were a pious lot, or arriving on this new Eden pushed them that way, because the first thing they did upon disembarkation was build a cathedral and give thanks to God for their safe deliverance. A year passed. Hypercasting was still in its infancy back then, barely able to carry the simplest of messages in coded sequence. The news that came filtering back down the beams to Earth was like the sound of screams from a locked room in the depths of an empty mansion. The two ecosystems had met and clashed like armies on a battlefield from which there was no retreat. Of the million-odd colonists aboard the Lorca, over 70% died within 18 months of touchdown. Back to the lab. These days, we've got it down to a fine art. Nothing organic leaves the hull until the eco-modeler has the whole host ecosystem down. Automated probes go out and prowl the new globe, sucking in samples. The AI digests the data, runs a model against a theoretical terrestrial presence at a couple of hundred times real-world speed, and flags the potential clashes. For anything that looks like a problem, it writes a solution. Genetech or nanotech. And from the correlated whole generates a settlement protocol. With the protocol laid down, everyone goes out to play. Inside the protocols for the 3 dozen or so settled worlds, you find certain advantageous terrestrial species cropping up time and again. They are the success stories of planet Earth. Tough, adaptive, evolutionary athletes to a creature. Most of them are plants, microbes, and insects. But among the supersized animals, there are a few that stand out. Merino sheep, grizzly bears, and seagulls feature at the top of the list. They're hard to wipe out. The water around the trawler was clogged with the white feathered corpses. In the unnatural stillness of the shoreline, They muffled the faint lapping of wavelets on the hull even further. The ship was a mess. It drifted listlessly against its anchors, the paint on the Somerville side scorched to black and bare metal glints by the wind from the blast. A couple of windows had blown out at the same time, and it looked as if some of the untidy pile of nets on deck had caught and melted. The angles of the deck winch were similarly charred. Anyone standing outside would probably have died from third-degree burns. There were no bodies on deck. We knew that from the virtuality.
"Nobody down here, either,"
said Luke Dupre, poking his head out of the mid-deck companionway.
"Nobody has been aboard for months, maybe a year. Food everywhere has been eaten by the bugs and the rats."
Suchiati frowned. "There's food out."
"Yeah, lots of it."
Dupre hauled himself out of the companionway and seated himself on the combing. The bottom half of his camellia-chrome coveralls stayed muddy dark for a second before it adjusted to the sunlit surroundings.
"Looks like a big party, but no one stayed around to do the clearing up."
"I've had parties like that," said Vong Savath.
Below, the unmistakable whoosh sizzle of a sunjet. Suchiati, Vong Savath, and I tensed in unison. Dupre grinned.
"Crickshank is shooting the rats," he said. "They are quite large."
Suchiati put up his weapon and looked up and down the deck, marginally more relaxed than when we'd come aboard.
"Estimates, Dupre. How many were there?"
"Rats?"
Dupre's grin widened.
"It's hard to tell."
I repressed a smile of my own.
"Crew," said Suchiati with an impatient gesture. "How many crew, Sergeant?"
Dupre shrugged, unimpressed by the rank pulling.
"I am not a chef, Captain. It is hard to tell."
"I used to be a chef,"
Amelie Vong Savath said unexpectedly.
"Maybe I'll go down and look."
"You stay here."
Suchiati stalked to the side of the trawler, kicking a seagull corpse out of the way.
"Starting now, I'd like a little less humor out of this command, and a little more application. You can start by getting this net hauled up. Dupre, you go back down and help Crickshank get rid of the rats."
Dupre sighed and set aside his sunjet. From his belt, he pulled an ancient-looking sidearm, chambered around, and sighted on the sky with it.
"My kind of work,"
he said cryptically, and swung back down the companionway, gun hand held high over his head. The induction rig crackled. Suchiati bent his head, listening. I fitted my own disconnected rig back in place.
"Is secured."
It was Sun Li Ping's voice. Suchiati had given her command of the other half of the team and sent them up the beach with Hand, Wardani, and Schneider, whom he clearly regarded as civilian irritations at best, liabilities at worst.
"Secured how?"
he snapped.
"We've set up perimeter sentry systems in an arc above the beach. 500-meter-wide baseline, 180-degree sweep. Should nail anything incoming from the interior or along the beach in either direction."
Sun paused for a moment, apologetic.
"That's line of sight only, but it's good for several kilometers. It's the best we can do."
"What about the mission objective?" I broke in. "Is it intact?"
Suchiati snorted. "Is it there?"
I shot him a glance. Suchiati thought we were on a ghost hunt. Envoy-enhanced gestalt scanning read it in his demeanor like screen labeling. He thought Wardani's gate was an archaeologue fantasy, overhyped from some vague original theory to make a good pitch to Mandrake. He thought Hand had been sold a cracked hull, and corporate greed had gobbled up the concept in a stampede to be first on the scene of any possible development option. He thought there was going to be some serious indigestion once the team arrived on site. He hadn't said as much in the construct briefing, but he wore his lack of conviction like a badge throughout. I couldn't really blame him. By their demeanor, about half the team thought the same. If Hand hadn't been offering such crazy, back-from-the-dead, war-exemption contracts, they probably would have laughed in his face. Not much more than a month ago, I'd nearly done the same to Schneider myself.
"Yes, it's here."
There was something peculiar in Sun's voice. As far as I could tell, she hadn't ever been one of the doubters. But now her tone bordered on awe.
"It's like nothing I've ever seen."
"Son, is it open?"
Not as far as we are aware, Lieutenant Kovach, no. I think you had better speak to Mistress Wardani if you want details.
I cleared my throat. Wardani, you there?
Busy.
Her voice was taut.
What did you find in the boat?
Nothing yet.
Yeah, well, same here. Out.
I glanced over at Sugiati again. He was focused on the middle distance, new Maori face betraying nothing. I grunted, tugged the rig off, and went to find out how the deck winch worked. Behind me, I heard him calling in a progress report from Hansen. The winch turned out not much different from a shuttle loader, and with Vong Savath's help, I got the mechanism powered up before Sugiati was finished on the comlink. He wandered over just in time to see the boom swing out smoothly and lower the mandagrab for the first haul. Dragging in the nets proved another story. It took us a good 20 minutes to get the hang of it, by which time the rat hunt was over, and Cruikshank and Dupre had joined us. Even then it was no joke maneuvering the cold, soaking heavy drapes of net over the side and onto the deck in some sort of order. None of us was a fisherman, and it was clear that there were some substantial skills involved in the process that we didn't have. We slipped and fell over a lot. It turned out to be worth it. Tangled in the last folds to come aboard were the remains of two corpses, naked apart from the still shining lengths of chain that weighted them down at the knees and chest. The fish had picked them down to bone and skin that looked like torn oilcloth wrapping. Their eyeless skulls lolled together in the suspended net like the heads of drunks sharing a good joke. Floppy necks and wide grins. We stood looking up at them for a while.
Good guess, I said to Sugiati.
It made sense to look.
He stepped closer and looked speculatively up at the naked bodies.
They've been stripped and threaded into the net. Arms and legs, and the ends of the two chains. Whoever did this didn't want them coming up. Doesn't make much sense. Why hide the bodies when the ship is here drifting for anyone to come out from Sabaville and take for salvage?
Yeah, but nobody did, Vong Savath pointed out.
Dupre turned and shaded his eyes to look at the horizon, where Sabaville still smoldered.
The war?
I recalled dates, recent history, calculated back. Hadn't come this far west a year ago, but it was cutting loose down south. I nodded toward the twists of smoke. They would have been scared. Not likely to come across here for anything that might draw orbital fire, or something maybe mined to suck in a remote bombardment. Remember Bootkinnery Town?
Vividly,
said Amelie Vong Savath, pressing fingers to her left cheekbone. That was about a year ago. Would have been all over the news. That bulk carrier down in the harbor, there wouldn't have been a civilian salvage team on the planet working after that.
So why hide these guys at all?
Asked Cruikshank. I shrugged. Keeps them out of sight. Nothing for aerial surveillance to reel in and sniff over. Bodies might have triggered a local investigation back then, back before things really got out of hand in Kempopolis.
Indigo City, Sugiati said pointedly.
Yeah, don't let Zhang hear you calling it that.
Cruikshank grinned.
He already jumped down my throat for calling Da Nang a terror strike, and I meant it as a fucking compliment.
Whatever. I rolled my eyes. The point is, without bodies, this is just a fishing boat someone hasn't been back for. That doesn't attract much attention in the run-up to a global revolution.
It does if the boat was hired in Somerville. Sugiati shook his head. But even, it's still of local interest. Who were these guys? Isn't that old Chang's trawler out there? Come on, Kovach. It's only a couple of dozen kilometers.
There's no reason to assume this boat's local. I gestured out at the placid ocean. On this planet you could sail a boat like this one all the way up from Bootkinnery and never spill your coffee.
Yeah, but you could hide the bodies from aerial surveillance by chucking them down into the galley with the rest of the mess,
objected Cruikshank.
It doesn't add up.
Luc Dupre reached up and shifted the net slightly. The skulls bobbed and leaned.
The stacks are gone, he said. They were put in the water to hide the rest of their identity. Faster than leaving them for the rats, I think.
Depends on the rats.
Are you an expert?
Maybe it was a burial,
offered Amelie Vongsavath.
In a net?
We're wasting time,
Suchiati said loudly.
Dupre, get them down, wrap them up, and put them somewhere the rats can't get at them. We'll run a post-mortem with the auto-surgeon back on the Nagini later. Vongsavath and Cruikshank, I want you to go through this boat from beak to backside. Look for anything that might tell us what happened here.
That's stem to stern, sir,
Vongsavath said primly.
Whatever. Anything that might tell us something. The clothing that came off these two, maybe, or...
He shook his head, irritable with the awkward new factors.
Anything. Anything at all. Get on with it. Lieutenant Kovac, I'd like you to come with me. I want to check on our perimeter defenses.
Sure.
I scooped up the lie with a slight smile. Suchiati didn't want to check on the perimeter. He'd seen Sun and Hansen's resumes, just like me. They didn't need their work checked. He didn't want to see the perimeter. He wanted to see the gate.
Chapter 20
Schneider had described it to me several times. Wardani had sketched it for me once in a quiet moment at Roespinoegi's. An imaging shock on the Angkor Road had run up a 3D graphic from Wardani's input for the mandrake pitch. Later, Hand had the mandrake machines blow up the image to a full-scale construct we could walk around in virtual. None of it came close. It stood in the man-made cavern like some vertically stretched vision from the dimensionalist school. Some element out of the nightmare techno-military landscapes of Molongo or Osupile. There was a gaunt foldedness to the structure, like 6 or 7 10-meter-tall vampire bats crushed back-to-back in a defensive phalanx. There was none of the passive openness that the word gate suggested. In the soft light filtering down through chinks in the rocks above, the whole thing looked hunched and waiting. The base was triangular, about 5 meters on a side, though the lower edges bore less resemblance to a geometric shape than to something that had grown down into the ground like tree roots. The material was an alloy I'd seen in Martian architecture before, a dense, black-clouded surface that would feel like marble or onyx to the touch, but always carried a faint static charge. The technoglyph paneling was dull green and ruby, mapped in odd, irregular waves around the lower section, but never rising higher than 1.5 meters from the ground. Toward the top of this limit, the symbols seemed to lose both coherence and strength. They thinned out, grew less well-defined, and even the style of the engraving seemed more hesitant. It was as if, Sun said later, the Martian technoscribes were afraid to work too close to what they had created on the plinth above. Above, the structure folded rapidly in on itself as it rose, creating a series of compressed black alloy angles and upward-leading edges that ended in a short spire. In the long splits between the folds, the black clouding on the alloy faded to a dirty translucence, and inside this, the geometry seemed to continue folding in on itself in some indefinable way that was painful to look at for too long.
"Believe it now?"
I asked Suchiati as he stood beside me, staring. He didn't respond for a moment, and when he did, there was the same slight numbness in his voice that I'd heard from Sun Li Ping over the comlink.
"It is not still," he said quietly.
"It feels in motion, like turning."
"Maybe it is."
Sun had come up with us, leaving the rest of the team down by the Nagini. No one else seemed over keen to spend time either in or near the cavern. "It's supposed to be a hyperspatial link," I said, moving sideways in an attempt to break the hold the thing's alien geometry was exerting. "If it maintains a line through to wherever, then maybe it moves in hyperspace, even when it's shut down."
"Or maybe it cycles,"
Sun suggested.
"Like a beacon."
Unease. I felt it course through me at the same time as I spotted it in the twitch across Suchiati's face. Bad enough that we were pinned down here on this exposed tongue of land without the added thought that the thing we had come to unlock might be sending off come-and-get-me signals in a dimension we as a species had only the vaguest of handles on.
"We're gonna need some lights in here," I said.
The spell broke. Suchiati blinked hard and looked up at the falling rays of light. They were graying out with perceptible speed as evening advanced across the sky outside.
"We'll have it blasted out," he said.
I exchanged an alarmed glance with Sun.
"Have what blasted?" I asked cautiously.
Suchiati gestured.
"The rock. Nagini runs a four-mounted ultra-vibe battery for ground assault. Hansen should be able to clear the whole thing back this far without putting a scratch on the artifact."
Sun coughed.
"I don't think Commander Han will approve of that, sir. He ordered me to bring up a set of Angier lamps before dark, and Mistress Wardani has asked for remote monitoring systems to be installed so she can work directly on the gate from..."
"All right, Lieutenant, thank you."
Suchiati looked around the cavern once more.
"I'll talk to Commander Han."
He strode out. I glanced at Sun and winked.
"That's a conversation I want to hear," I said.
Back at the Nagini, Hansen, Schneider, and Jiang were busy erecting the first of the rapid deployment bubble fabs. Han was braced in one corner of the assault ship's loading hatch, watching a cross-legged Wardani sketch something on a memory board. There was an unguarded fascination in his expression that made him look suddenly younger.
"Some problem, Captain?" he asked as we came up the ramp.
"I want that thing," said Suchiati, jerking a thumb back over his shoulder. "Out in the open, where we can watch it. I'm having Hansen vibe-blast the rocks out of the way."
"Out of the question." Han went back to watching what the archaeologue was doing. "We can't risk exposure at this stage."
"Or damage to the gate,"
Wardani said sharply.
"Or damage to the gate," agreed the executive. "I'm afraid your team are going to have to work with the cavern as it is, Captain. I don't believe there's any risk involved. The bracing the previous visitors put up appears to be solid."
"I've seen the bracing," said Suchiati. "Bonding epoxy is not a substitute for a permanent structure, but that's..."
Sergeant Hansen seemed quite impressed with it. Han's urbane tone was edged with irritation. "But if you are concerned, please feel free to reinforce the current arrangement in any way you see fit."
"I was going to say," Suchiati said evenly, "that the bracing is beside the point. I am not concerned with the risk of collapse. I am urgently concerned with what is in the cavern."
Wardani looked up from her sketching.
"Well, that's good, Captain,"
she said brightly.
"You've gone from polite disbelief to urgent concern in less than 24 hours of real time. What exactly are you concerned about?"
Suchiati looked uncomfortable.
"This artifact," he said. "You claim it's a gate. Can you give me any guarantees that nothing will come through it from the other side?"
"Not really, no."
"Do you have any idea what might come through?"
Wardani smiled.
"Not really, no."
"Then I'm sorry, Mr. Wardani. It makes military sense to have the Nagini's main weaponry trained on it at all times."
"This is not a military operation, Captain." Hand was working on ostentatiously bored now. "I thought I made that clear during briefing. You are part of a commercial venture, and the specifics of our commerce dictate that the artifact cannot be exposed to aerial view until it is contractually secured. By the terms of the incorporation charter, that will not become the case until what is on the other side of the gateway is tagged with a Mandrake ownership buoy."
"And if the gate chooses to open before we are ready, and something hostile comes through it?"
"Something hostile?"
Wardani set aside her memory board, apparently amused.
"Something such as what?"
"You would be in a better position than I to evaluate that, Mistress Wardani,"
Suchiati said stiffly.
"My concern is simply for the safety of this expedition."
Wardani sighed.
"They weren't vampires, Captain,"
she said wearily.
"I'm sorry?"
"The Martians. They weren't vampires. Or demons. They were just a technologically advanced race with wings. That's all. There's nothing on the other side of that thing."
She stabbed a finger in the general direction of the rocks.
"That we won't be able to build ourselves in a few thousand years." If we can get a lock on our militaristic tendencies, that is.
Is that intended as an insult, Mr. Swardani?
Take it any way you like, Captain. We are, all of us, already dying slowly of radiation poisoning. A couple of dozen kilometers in that direction, 100,000 people were vaporized yesterday by soldiers.
Her voice was starting to rise, trembling at base.
Anywhere else on about 60% of this planet's landmass, your chances of an early violent death are excellent, at the hands of soldiers. Elsewhere, the camps will kill you with starvation or beatings if you step out of political line. This service, too, brought to us by soldiers. Is there something else I can add to clarify my reading of militarism for you?
Mr. Swardani.
Han's voice held a tight strain I hadn't heard before. Below the ramp, Hansen, Schneider, and Zhang had stopped what they were doing and were looking over toward the raised voices.
I think we're getting off the point. We were discussing security.
Were we?
Wardani forced a shaky laugh, and her voice evened out.
Well, Captain, let me put it to you that in the 7 decades I have been a qualified archaeologue, I have never come across evidence to suggest that the Martians had anything more unpleasant to offer than what men like you have already unleashed across the face of Sanction IV. Excluding the small matter of the fallout from Sabreville, you are probably safer sitting in front of that gate than anywhere else in the Northern Hemisphere at the moment.
There was a small silence. Maybe you want to train the Najini's main guns in the entrance to the cavern, I suggested. Same effect. In fact, with the remote monitoring in place, it'll be better. If the monsters with half-meter fangs turn up, we can collapse the tunnel on them.
A good point.
Seemingly casual, Hand moved to position himself carefully in the hatch between Wardani and Suchiati.
That seems the best compromise, does it not, Captain?
Suchiati read the executive stance and took the hint. He threw a salute and turned on his heel. As he went down the ramp past me, he glanced up. He didn't quite have his previous immobility of feature down with a new Maori face. He looked betrayed. You find innocence in the strangest places. At the base of the ramp, he caught one of the gull corpses with his foot and stumbled slightly. He kicked the clump of feathers away from him in a spray of turquoise sand.
Hansen, he snapped tightly. Zhang, get all this shit off the beach. I want it cleared back 200 meters from the ship on all sides.
Ole Hansen raised an eyebrow and slotted an ironic salute in beside it. Suchiati wasn't looking. He'd already stalked away toward the water's edge. Something wasn't right. Hansen and Zhang used the drives from two of the expedition's grav bikes to blow the gull corpses back in a skirling, knee-high storm front of feathers and sand. In the space they cleared around the Najini, the encampment took rapid shape, speeded up by the return of Dupre, Vongsavath, and Cruikshank from the trawler. By the time it was fully dark, 5 bubble fabs had sprouted from the sand in a rough circle around the assault ship. They were uniform in size, camellia chrome-coated, and featureless apart from small aluminum numerals above each door. Each fab was equipped to sleep 4 in twin bunk rooms, separated by a central living space. But 2 of the units had been assembled in a non-standard configuration, with half the bed space, one to serve as a general meeting room, and the other as Tanya Wardani's lab. I found the archaeologue there, still sketching. The hatch was open, freshly lasered out and hinged back on epoxy welding that still smelled faintly of resin. I touched the chime pad and leaned in.
"What do you want?"
she asked, not looking up from what she was doing. "It's me."
"I know who it is, Kovach. What do you want?"
"An invitation over the threshold." She stopped sketching and sighed, still not looking up.
"We're not in virtual anymore, Kovach. I
wasn't looking for a fuck." She hesitated, then met my gaze levelly.
"That's just as well."
"So, do I get to come in?"
"Suit yourself."
I ducked through the entrance and crossed to where she was sitting, picking my way among the litter of hard copy sheets the memory board had churned out. They were all variations on a theme. Sequences of technoglyphs with scrawled annotation. As I watched, she put a line through the current sketch. Getting anywhere?
Slowly.
She yawned.
I don't remember as much as I thought. Going to have to redo some of the secondary configs from scratch again.
I propped myself against a table edge. So how long do you reckon? She shrugged.
A couple of days. Then there's testing.
How long for that?
The whole thing, primaries and secondaries? I don't know. Why? Your bone marrow starting to itch already?
I glanced through the open door to where the fires in Sabreville cast a dull red glow on the night sky. This soon after the blast, and this close in, the elemental exotics would be out in force. Strontium-90, Iodine-131, and all their numerous friends, like a methed-up party of Harlan family heirs crashing Wharfside Millsport with their chittering bright enthusiasm, wearing their unstable subatomic jackets like swamp panther skin, and wanting into everywhere, every cell they could fuck up with their heavily jeweled presence. I twitched despite myself. I'm just curious.
An admirable quality. Must make soldiering difficult for you.
I snapped open one of the camp chairs stacked beside the table and lowered myself into it. I think you're confusing curiosity with empathy.
Really?
Yes, really. Curiosity is a basic monkey trait. Torturers are full of it. Doesn't make you a better human being.
Well, I suppose you'd know.
It was an admirable riposte. I didn't know if she'd been tortured in the camp. In the momentary flare of anger, I hadn't cared. But she never flinched as the words came out. Why are you behaving like this, Wardani?
I told you, we're not in virtual anymore.
No. I waited. Eventually she got up and went across to the back wall of the compartment, where a bank of monitors for the remote gear showed the gate from a dozen slightly different angles.
You'll have to forgive me, Kovac, she said heavily. Today I saw 100,000 people murdered to clear the way for our little venture. And I know we didn't do it, but it's a little too convenient for me not to feel responsible. If I go for a walk, I know there are little bits of them blowing around in the wind out there. And that's without those heroes of the revolution you killed so efficiently this morning. I'm sorry, Kovac. I have no training at this sort of thing.
You won't want to talk about the two bodies we fished out of the trawl nets, then.
Is there something to talk about?
She didn't look around. Dupre and Jiang just got through with the autosurgeon. Still no idea what killed them. No trace of trauma in any of the bone structure, and there's not a great deal else left to work from.
I moved up beside her, closer to the monitors.
I'm told there are tests we can do with bone at the cellular level, but I have a feeling they aren't going to tell us anything either. That got her looking at me.
Why?
Because whatever killed them has something to do with this. I tapped the glass of a monitor where the gate loomed close up. And this is like nothing any of us have seen before.
You think something came through the gate at the witching hour?
She asked scornfully.
The vampires got them?
Something got them, I said mildly. They didn't die of old age. Their stacks are gone.
Doesn't that rule out the vampire option? Stack excision is a peculiarly human atrocity, isn't it?
Not necessarily. Any civilization that could build a hyperportal must have been able to digitize consciousness.
There's no actual evidence for that.
Not even common sense?
Common sense.
The scorn was back in her voice.
The same common sense that said 1,000 years ago that obviously the sun goes around the earth. Just look at it. The common sense that Bogdanovich appealed to when he set up Hub theory. Common sense is anthropocentric, Kovac. It assumes that because this is the way human beings turned out, it has to be the way any intelligent technological species would turn out.
I've heard some pretty convincing arguments along those lines.
Yeah, haven't we all?
She said shortly.
Common sense for the common herd, and why bother to feed them anything else? What if Martian ethics didn't permit re-slaving, Kovac? Ever think of that? What if death means you've proved yourself unworthy of life? That even if you could be brought back,
You have no right to it.
In a technologically advanced culture, a starfaring culture, this is bullshit, Ordani.
No, it's a theory. Function-related raptor ethics. Ferrer and Yoshimoto at Bradbury. And at the moment, there's very little hard evidence around to disprove it.
Do you believe it? She sighed and went back to her seat.
Of course I don't believe it. I'm just trying to demonstrate that there's more to eat at this party than the cozy little certainties human science is handing around. We know almost nothing about the Martians, and that's after hundreds of years of study. What we think we know could be proved completely wrong at any moment, easily. Half the things we dig up, we have no idea what they are, and we still sell them as fucking coffee table trinkets. Right now, someone back on Latimer has probably got the encoded secret of a faster-than-light drive mounted on their fucking living room wall.
She paused.
And it's probably upside down.
I laughed out loud. It shattered the tension in the fab. Wardani's face twitched in an unwilling smile.
No, I mean it,
she muttered.
You think just because I can open this gate that we've got some kind of handle on it? Well, we haven't. You can't assume anything here. You can't think in human terms.
Okay, fine. I followed her back to the center of the room and reclaimed my own seat. In fact, the thought of a human stack being retrieved by some kind of Martian gate commando, the thought of that personality being downloaded into a Martian virtuality, and what that might do to a human mind, was making my spine crawl. It was an idea I would have been just as happy never to have come up with. But you're the one who's beginning to sound like a vampire story now.
I'm just warning you.
Okay, I'm warned. Now, tell me something else. How many other archaeologues knew about this site?
Outside my own team?
She considered.
We filed with Central Processing and Landfall, but that was before we knew what it was. It was just listed as an obelisk, artifact of unknown function. But like I said, AUFs are practically every second thing we dig up.
You know, Han says there's no record of an object like this in the Landfall Registry.
Yeah, I read the report. Files got lost, I guess.
Seems a little too convenient to me, and files may get lost, but not files on the biggest find since Bradbury.
I told you we filed it as an AUF, an obelisk, another obelisk. We'd already turned up a dozen structural pieces along this coast by the time we found this one.
And you never updated? Not even when you knew what it was?
No.
She gave me a crooked smile.
The Guild has always given me a pretty hard time about my Wysinski-esque tendencies, and a lot of the scratches I took on got tarred by association. Cold-shouldered by colleagues, slagged off in academic journals, the usual conformist stuff. When we realized what we'd found, I think we all felt the Guild could wait until we were ready to make them eat their words in style.
And when the war started, you buried it for the same reasons?
Got it in one.
She shrugged.
It might sound childish now, but at the time we were all pretty angry. I don't know if you'd understand that, how it feels to have every piece of research you do, every theory you come up with, trashed because you once took the wrong side in a political dispute.
I thought briefly back to the Inanen hearings. It sounds familiar enough.
I think...
She hesitated.
I think there was something else as well. You know, the night we opened the gate for the first time, we went crazy. Big party, lots of chemicals, lots of talk. Everyone was talking about full professorships back on Latimer. They said I'd be made an honorary Earth scholar in recognition of my work.
She smiled.
I think I even made an acceptance speech. I don't remember that stage of the evening too well. Never did, even the next morning.
She sighed and rid herself of the smile.
The next morning we started to think straight, started to think about what was really going to happen. We knew that if we filed, we'd lose control. The Guild would fly in a master with all the right political affiliations to take charge of the project, and we'd be sent home with a pat on the back. Oh, we'd be back from the academic wilderness, of course, but only at a price. We'd be allowed to publish, but only after careful vetting to make sure there wasn't too much Wysinski in the text. There'd be work, but not on an independent basis. Consultancy,
She pronounced the word as if it tasted bad.
On someone else's projects. We'd be well paid, but paid to keep quiet.
Better than not getting paid at all. A grimace.